And good morning. Good morning for episode 33 of Coffee with Dakota. That was our Get Started signal. Happy to have you joining us today. It's so much fun to see all the names logging in. And Paula has just announced something amazing, which I'm going to repeat if you don't mind, because those who don't have the insider access, they might need to hear it as well. For the EarthCo Labs, which we've just completed, the one in Del Rey, and it was fabulous. I've got a bunch to tell you about that, maybe in between the questions or something. There's a buy one, get one half price. So if you're looking at Memphis or Chicago and you'd like to participate in that, and the best part of the deal was having the CMG coordinators and the coders in the same room, people from different aspects, not just those titles, of course, but people from different worldviews, if you will, so that their function does not normally speak openly to the other function, and they were doing that together and hashing out the cases. That was awesome. So just reach out to me on whatever way you found Coffee with Dakota. We're very excited to share that with you, and I'll give you more details later. But for now, I want to go ahead and jump in and get our first question. So Paula and Heather, I think that you guys are going to share this one. This first one is from an inpatient rehab background, and Deborah from Texas. Deborah, I think you might have even been a winner one day of the mugging, where you got the official Coffee with Dakota mug. But here is the question. She says, I have a patient with a congenital spina bifida and neuromuscular stenosis. The patient also has neurogenic bowel and bladder. The patient had surgery for the stenosis and had multiple other issues due to the spina bifida. Would I put this patient in 12.1 impairment or an SCN? Now, personally, I've never heard that SCN before, so perhaps one of you two could enlighten me when you answer the question.
Okay. Hey, this is Heather. Based on your statement, the conditions are congenital, and you would report that with the 12.1. So based on what you're stating the conditions are and on our research, it indicates that neuromuscular conditions are likely due to the spina bifida. So the ICD-10 rules do not allow that automatic linkage, unfortunately. So if the physician did not associate those conditions, then a query would be appropriate for linking them or validating that the neuromuscular stenosis was also congenital. And if that was the case, then we would do 12.9, maybe more appropriate, if it was the focus of care. However, we didn't find a diagnosis of neuromuscular stenosis in our research, so we would recommend clarification from the physician that whether this was neuromuscular scoliosis or some other neuromuscular conditions. And also, just as an aside, symptoms of spina bifida also include bowel and bladder issues.
Yeah, Heather, do you mind if I clarify with this scenario just a little bit?
Sure.
If the physician stated congenital spina bifida or congenital neuromuscular stenosis, and that's the term that we did not find as a diagnosis, whether it was, some type of spinal stenosis, it needed to be a little more, clear to us. The IGC options, as you stated, are 12.1 or 12.9 based on what the physician states is the focus of rehab. If the physician states the neuromuscular stenosis is due to the spina bifida, then the 12.1 would be the IGC. It depends, again, on how the physician states it. However, if the physician did not associate the neuromuscular congenital condition as congenital, or he didn't associate it to the spina bifida, you may actually go with neuro as another choice because, again, it's not only the diagnosis that's bringing the patient in. So was the spina bifida underlying cause of the rehab admission? Or was it more a neuromuscular condition that was not associated to the spina bifida? It was difficult to tell in the scenario that was sent in, so we had a little bit of discussion back and forth about that one. Pam?
Yes, thank you. I'm going to stay with an inpatient rehab for the second question, but before I give it to you, I want to tell you one of the things I overheard as you were ending the EarthCo lab. There was a lady who was the coding manager of an IRF, and she also did inpatient coding, and she said it was closing a lot of gaps for her and the knowledge gaps that she didn't even realize she had. And then another one that happened to be a PPS coordinator, she said, I feel so much more confident. Before this, I struggled a lot with spinal cords. So anyway, those are just some comments. Let me go over to Ohio, where Sherry has this. Actually, it's more than one question. So I'm going to just start, and maybe I'll need to give you these other pieces of the question as we go through. I need some clarification, Sherry says, regarding queries and comorbid conditions. So a patient is discharged, and a physician query was sent prior to the discharge, but the query was not answered or signed by the physician until after the discharge. Am I able to code the comorbid conditions on the IRF-PI?
And this is Paula. Yeah, I'm going to take that one. Typically, yes, this may be different from state to state, however. And, you know, for years, Sherry, we have performed post-discharge queries. In most recent years, we moved to CDI and more concurrent queries. So post-discharge queries still happen in most hospitals, sometimes even post-bill queries. As you know, queries are requesting clarification because there's evidence that was unclear. CMS agrees with this practice according to a Medicare Learning Matters article, which was SC 1027. What it states is, lastly, CMS providers to ensure that any information that affects the billed services and is acquired after physician documentation is complete must be added to the existing documentation in accordance with accepted standards of amending medical record documentation. As long as the query follows the appropriate rules, i.e. it's not leading, and is clarifying information not introducing new information, I guess, then that query would be appropriate.
Thank you. Okay, so now I think these are nuances. Yes, the next portion of it is if the coder is behind on admission coding and the patient has been discharged, is the coder able to query the physician regarding the comorbid condition?
Hey, Sam, this is Heather. So if there's evidence it was there and it's consistent with the treatment provided, then we don't see a problem with it as long as you're not trying to get the physician to state something that was not present and treated.
Okay. And also, if the condition is documented by therapy or nursing after discharge?
Let me jump in on that one, It's a, you know, why would the condition be documented after discharge by ancillary staff? Isn't their documentation supposed to be contemporaneous? That was just a question, you know, that we were asking. I know it may happen sometimes. It seems like that this is an opportunity for education and maybe a process opportunity. But, you know, and we can help with that on the consulting side of what we do. But the, you know, other piece of that is from a coding perspective, we are utilizing the physician documentation and the ancillary documentation is supportive of the physician. We're not allowed to use only like therapy notes or nursing notes to select codes from.
Yes. And okay, so now here's another piece of the same question. I've been querying for specificity after discharge. Is it okay to enter a more specified comorbid condition on the IRF-PI? For example, if the patient was dysphagia, which was documented by the physician, but speech therapy has oropharyngeal dysphagia in their notes.
Well, here's what you have to do because we cannot code from the speech therapy notes, but we absolutely can use those notes as clinical evidence to query the physician. So we can only document what the physician, we can only code what the physician has documented as validated.
Okay. And then if a diagnosis is only documented in the discharge summary, am I able to code and or query?
So, yeah, but for the IRF-PI, the timing of recognition should be made clear because if it was recognized in the last 2 days, then you can't report that on the IRF-PI. However, if the physician documents that condition in the discharge summary, but he states that the condition was present on admission or that it occurred during day 3 and the discharge was at least at day 5, then you could report that on the IRF-PI. Other record information should be consistent with the treatment of the condition at the time of recognition.
Okay. Well, and also she says, I know that Section 2 of the IRF-PI manual under 24, comorbid conditions, says that on the day prior to the day of the rehab discharge or the day of discharge, it shouldn't be listed in the discharge assessment since these comorbidities have less effect on the resources consumed during the entire day. So I'm kind of looking for some clarification on this.
Right, so the IRF-PI manual states that conditions recognized on the day of or the day preceding discharge may not be reported on the IRF-PI, but these can be reported on the UB. If the condition was recognized prior to those days or documented on discharge with validation of the day on which they were recognized, then they can be reported if they were before the day of discharge or the day preceding discharge.
Okay. Do we have time to do one more?
Yeah, let's push it in, Pam.
Okay. Okay. So let's move over to South Carolina and take a question from Terry, who is not in an inpatient rehab. But before we do, I'm going to give you a couple more quotes really, really fast. One group of people, they're like, we really appreciate the small group because we, you know, small group they were working in, because they had difficult questions to ask and they felt pretty open and answered to ask those questions there. And then they said, we need a lot more of that. So, okay, that was my commercial. Last thing is a question from Carrie in South Carolina. She says, in a pro-fee setting, which diagnosis would you include for procedures only? Would you only code the findings, or would you include the indications if they didn't conflict or risk factors? For example, heart cath is listed, and the recommendation is aggressive risk factors, modification of hyperlipidemia and hypertension. And then the second example, 93460 for cath placement in coronary artery, and the recommendation is he appears volumic today with borderline elevation of the right heart filling pressures. Given his obesity, I would suggest an outpatient sleep study to rule out sleep apnea. Continue current diuretic dosing, volume overload likely related to heart failure with preserved ejection fraction, possibly cirrhosis and possible right heart dysfunction. Proceed with sleep study as noted above. So those are her two scenarios and the question.
Okay, this is Heather again. So first, in your scenario, there are a few things to make clear. In the outpatient setting, you would not report unconfirmed conditions. So the conditions listed as possible, probable, and likely are not reported. Guidelines also indicate that symptoms are not reported when there's a definitive diagnosis. The ICD-10 guidelines indicate that the reason for the encounter or the procedure is reported first, and other diagnoses that are relevant to the encounter are also reported. So your scenario does not clarify whether the patient had the cath to respond. We'll presume it was the CHF. The coding guidelines require automatic association of the hypertension and the heart failure. So if this was the reason for the procedure, it would be the primary code. Then hyperlipidemia, obesity, and the volume overload, which were all relevant to the encounter, would also be reported.
Okay, yeah, Heather, let me jump in here, too. Medicare agrees with that statement. When we were doing a little research just to get you the, you know, chapter and verse of information, the Medicare Claims Processing Manual, Chapter 23, Chapter 10.3, which is for outpatient claim diagnosis reporting, it states for outpatient claims, meaning physicians and outpatient hospitals, providers report the full diagnosis code for the diagnosis shown to be chiefly responsible for the outpatient service. For instance, if a patient is seen on an outpatient basis for an evaluation of a symptom, such as a cough, for which the definitive is not made, then the symptom is reported. If during the course of the outpatient evaluation and treatment a definitive diagnosis is made, for example, bronchitis, the definitive diagnosis is reported. If the patient arrives at the hospital for examination or testing without a referring diagnosis and cannot provide a complaint, a symptom, or a diagnosis, then the outpatient provider would report the code for that encounter, so encounter for this service or that service, which is a Z code. For outpatient claims, CMS says providers report the full diagnosis codes up to 24 other diagnoses that coexisted in addition to the diagnosis reported as the principal diagnosis. For instance, if the patient is referred to a hospital for evaluation of hypertension and the medical record also documents diabetes, diabetes would be reported as another diagnosis, a comorbidity. Additional information and training is available on the CMS website at www.cms.gov/Medicare/coding/ICD-10/index.html, and we'll add a link on following this posting of Coffee with the Coder so you can see the document that we referred to. So thank you guys for your time today, Pam.
Yes, thank you, thank you. Okay, now it's time to mug somebody. We've got these lovely official Coffee with the Coder mugs with some special branding on the side, and I have written down the names of the people who asked the questions, and I'm just kind of like stirring them up on my desk, and we're going to find out who's going to win one, and let me see who the answer is. Deborah in Texas, you win. Woo-hoo. I'll be reaching out to you to see where you'd like this mug to go. I invite all of you to send in a mugshot, which would be a picture of you, a selfie with some AQIQ branded item. So like the website next to you or something that you've purchase from us, or if you've been one of these winners of the mug, then, you know, your mug shot with you and your mug. So that would get you into the Insider's Facebook page, and we just like interacting with you. So welcome to do that. Thanks so much for joining us for episode 33. The next episode will begin on April the 2nd at 10:10 a.m. We hope to listen and see you there.